is definitely not the first podcast featuring a discussion of pop culture and why we think you should like what we like. You should trust us because we're librarians. I'm Anna and it was 87 degrees today.
I'm Aline and where is spring?
I don't know. We just went straight from winter to summer as usual here in New England.
That is its way.
Every couple of weeks we'll get together and chat about a pop culture topic or two, what we think and how we feel. We'll end the show with our current obsessions. Today we have some very special guests, return visitors to our show. You've already heard one of them.
Unsurprisingly.
She's bossy. That's why she breaks in.
One of two. Should I, like, introduce myself now?
Go for it.
This is Margaret H. Hula Hoop Willison. I am one of Pop Culture Happy Hour's fourth chairs, one third of the podcast Appointment Television, and most pertinent to our work today, one half of the Two Bossy Dames miniature media empire, which I wrangle with Sophie.
Hi, I'm Sophie. and I wrangle Margaret.
It's a full-time job.
And contribute all of our valuable One Direction and Harry Styles coverage.
Right.
Oh, that's my gosh. And thank you for that.
Yeah.
You're so welcome. Please know that I'm extremely prepared for the whole thing, but like extremely prepared for that segment.
For the
later.
Obsessions segment?
Correct. That is correct. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it's safe to call Sophie the internet's preeminent expert on young old Harry Styles enthusiasm.
That's fair.
Yeah, I think that's
for yeah. young olds, yes.
For young olds.
Not like globally. That would be like
you're a tremendous human overstatement. Adult with a job, a husband, and a child to raise.
You
can't spend the time in the Styles mines.
How's the raising of that husband going, by the way?
The raising of the husband? Well, his parents did a tremendous job with that. I really had no further work to accomplish on that score.
Excellent.
And I appreciate them for that. The child raising is also going very well. I take a more, you know, hands-on role with the raising.
A little more active work there.
A little more, yes, because I don't actually travel back in time.
Just
not yet, exactly.
Well,
who knows?
If you find yourself laid up in the hospital,
mm-hmm.
you could engage in some kind of time-travel-y detective work.
I see what you're doing here.
Oh my god.
That would be cool. I really like how you queued that up. That was
Are you trying to introduce our topic, Anna?
No,
it was
actually,
so
I was
skillful.
I was going to mention that we have not yet bought our Two to Bossy Dames clock.
So we have no idea what time it is.
So we don't know what time it is.
You guys who bought the clock, because I just assumed.
What time is it?
Bought. That it was you guys.
It's showtime.
So someone
else
bought the clock.
Shouts that.
So it's not just going to be, it's going to be more than one clock.
Yeah, really? There's going to be more than one.
I'm
going
to put it on a list of things to do before we go to on spring break.
Okay.
I'm not drinking out of any Dames branded merchandise tonight, but I was using my Dames branded multi-purpose carry-all pouch to carry my e-reader earlier today, and I felt great about that.
Very good, very good.
Yeah, thank you.
So I've been trying to get Anna to draw a picture of me that I could have emblazoned on everything I own, but it hasn't come to pass yet.
Well, you know, if Anna's recalcitrant and continues to be, Simony Blocker was very good at what she did.
She really was. You guys look great.
I feel like she'd really kill it drawing you.
She would. Aline.
Definitely.
So we'll keep that in mind.
I highly recommend her.
Thank you. I'll keep that in mind if my resident artist
fails. You haven't really pressed the point
Declined.
Very
no, I
hard.
I haven't really pressed it very hard.
I'm not sure you've asked at all.
But Anna, you executed that perfect transition and then we just fudged it.
That's how we do it here. So our topic today, what was it again?
I think we're reading Persuasion.
Oh, Persuasion is a great book.
It's an encore presentation.
We were going to read Mansfield Park as of the end of the last episode, but no one actually wanted to read Mansfield Park. So we decided to read.
I'm not.
The enthusiasm level was very low. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
We decided to read something else instead. And we are going to take a minute here to wave sadly at Allie, who couldn't make it today.
We miss you, Allie.
You were here.
We miss you a lot.
Yes.
And for today's episode, we read something completely different than Persuasion. The Daughter of Time by Josephine Tay, published in 1951. A mystery novel.
Considered, of sorts.
Considered by some to be one of the greatest mysteries of all time. Considered by others to not really be that much of a mystery. We can discuss that later.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So, to begin our discussion, I wonder if Margaret would give us a synopsis.
Okay, sure. So, this is one of Josephine Tay's Inspector Grant novels, and it falls close to the middle of the six she published about this fictional inspector. And in this particular book, rather than being out tracking down live murderers, Inspector Grant is laid up in bed after falling through a trap door while chasing a criminal and breaking both his legs. And to keep himself from going nuts with boredom, he starts looking into the murder of the two princes by their wicked uncle, Richard III, and discovers through, like, historical investigation that maybe Richard III is not the monster that we've all portrayed him as being, and does actually, like, zero gumshoe detective work. It's just, like, mostly historical scholarly study with a very wry sense of humor.
Yes.
Does that seem about right?
It does.
Yeah.
It seems that great.
That's a good synopsis. Great. Mm-hmm.
Sophie, was there anything that Margaret left out that you wanted to bring up?
No, I think she really captured the essence of it.
She did nail it. It's a short novel.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of digression to be done when talking about it.
I wanted to know from my co-panelists here, when you first read the book, I'm going to pass it to Aline here because it'll be short answer.
Today. I finished it today. I started it in the last couple of days. It has been on my list since college because it was mentioned to me as a mystery reader that I had to read it, and I have checked it out from the library multiple times over many years and never managed to start it. There was nothing wrong with it once I started it and read it, and now I'm done.
Okay.
Ta-da!
Mm-hmm. How about you, Sophie?
Good work. My parents are big mystery readers, and they had a copy in the house, and I eventually read it, I think, in college, because I've always had a thing about the Plantagenets, and I loved it. And that actually led me to read Alison Weir's book, The Princes in the Tower, which further exonerated Richard III.
That's good to know.
Yeah, that's a good book. I definitely recommend it. That's on my list for Reader's Advisory.
Excellent.
Later. I have a whole bunch of things for that. So this is the third time I've read it. I reread it a couple of years ago on audio, and this time I half read it on the page and half listened to it as an audiobook.
Do you have the Derek Jacobi audiobook, Soph?
I have access to your copy of it, and that's what I listen to.
It's so good.
He is very good.
And we listened to the first three chapters that way, and then we ran out of time and had to diverge in a snowy wood.
We could not keep up with Derek's deliberate pace.
His pacing was kind of deliberate, and we would have
and
had
we
to
postpone like, we gotta go, until we gotta
June.
Go, gotta go.
But it is definitely a good
audio,
an excellent audio performance.
Yeah, I feel like I end up listening to it at least once a year because I enjoy his performance so much. I'm so mad that Josephine Tay's stuff is so intermittently in print and so intermittently available on audio. Like right now, that Derek Jacobi one that I've got in my Audible is not available for sale in the Audible store.
What?
It flickers in and out. It's very weird. They've got the Carol Boyd version of Brat Farrar and also the Carol Boyd version of The Franchise Affair, which I bought and actually returned because, like, it's so entrenched in 1950s classism and sexism. Mm. But, like, it's just not super fun to read.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a very good and clever mystery, but the entire basis of it, and this is, like, one of Inspector Grant's sort of recurring features, is that he can kind of just know by faces and types who's a criminal and who isn't. And, like, shockingly, for books written in the 1950s, this doesn't conform problematically in most of the books with, like, class and gender distinctions, but in this one it super does. It's like a lying butter wouldn't melt in her mouth blonde girl and like a nice upper middle class family of brunettes pitted against one another, and like just by looking at the types you know who's guilty.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Oh, 1950s fiction.
But right? Look, for someone of her time, she's way better than Agatha Christie as far as racism, sexism, and classism are concerned.
So when did you first read it, Margaret?
Yeah, sure, that question. So I make little notes in my books, or I try to, about when I start them and when I finish them. I'm good at the first and not as good at the second. But I can tell you that this copy of The Daughter of Time was purchased for me by my dad February break 2001 on my first trip to London. It's pretty nifty. When I was 15, but about a month shy of being 16, I read this book for the first time. And I have to say, I don't think I loved it the first time through. I love it so much more now in relation to Inspector Grant across a number of books rather than just this one. But Anna, what about you?
Okay, so I read it in my early modern England class in college.
Yeah.
And I believe that my professor's purpose was twofold. One, to give us information about the period in an accessible way. And two, to make us understand that history is...
has its eyes on you.
History has its eyes on you, obviously. The history is written by groups of people with their own agendas, and that can't necessarily take things at face value and, you know, examine your sources.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was my main takeaway. We also read History in the Archives in that class by Natalie Zeman Davis. And so my copy has little notes in it. Aline was fortunate enough to have it to read. I don't know if she got anything out of my tiny notes. Probably not. But at the back, it has questions like, for Friday, how do you prove a negative?
That's math.
Right? So that is the problem with this mystery. How do you prove a negative?
Mm-hmm. Aline, coming to this book, expecting it to be a mystery novel, what did you make of it?
I was really, really mad at it last night.
That I was baffled. I was like, where is the mystery in this mystery novel?
Right. I wanted it to be more of a mystery, for sure. I'm like, you have an inspector in this. Why are we not gumshoeing it up? Why doesn't his sergeant come and help him? Although, I did like Brent Carradine a whole lot.
Oh, I love Brent.
He's a good lamb. King, Brent.
Yeah. All the characters are so well written.
They are. They were really vivid, considering the slimness and the almost Elmore Leonard-esque lack of description. I was very appreciative of that. I was so angry at it last night, and I don't know if it was because I was tired and I was worried about getting it finished, but I was really mad last night, and I was trying to parse my rage, and I don't think I was very successful. I think part of it was I don't know much about the Plantagenets in spite of the Shakespeare I've read, and I was a little stumped by a little bit of the politics because my English history comes later, and so I was feeling at sea and frustrated by that, and I needed Wikipedia with me instead of just trying to get through the book, but I didn't have time to go Wikipedia at all like I do when I run into this sort of thing. Yeah, that kind of sums up.
There are definitely a lot of names, and they don't hold your hand for most of it. They're like, you remember Stillington, right? And
I'm
like,
she's an English writer, and she's writing in a time when people had a little better basis in history, however
biased it may have been.
No?
Right? Because if you listen to how everyone talks about it, everybody's got like a couple catchphrases. Right. But it's sort of like I know Tippecanoe and Tyler too about William Henry Harrison. Though how I know it's about William Henry Harrison, God only knows. But like I know I'm not going to swear, right? I shouldn't swear.
Go ahead.
I know all about his cabinet. right? And so, like, you maybe might know a monarch, but you're getting kind of deep into the weeds with cardinals and court members and stuff like that, and you wouldn't, you know, she doesn't portray an English populace who's, like, up on their court figures necessarily. So I think she's just kind of resolutely plowing ahead. She does, like, a little bit of hand-holding and dot-connecting, but she does expect you to just hold those names in your head moving forward.
Yeah, and so imagine reading this in 1952 without Wikipedia. Because yeah, I was listening to it at work, you know, like, in my off-desk time, and I had Wikipedia handy to, like, check things while Derek was continuing.
Because you had plenty of time the phrases to look things up.
He's very measured.
So maybe it's just we need the Tudors to be made about the Plantagenets, because
oh my God, that would be awesome.
I would watch that so hard. Representations of
it's crazy
Henry VIII's
that we
court.
Don't have yeah. anything about the War of the Roses.
Well,
I mean,
so
the closest that
we have Shakespeare
about the War of the Roses is Game of Thrones.
No, there
wait
was
a minute.
They're setting that aside. There was a really good miniseries about that that aired on Masterpiece Theater a zillion years ago, but they definitely should update that. I don't remember. I'll have to look it up.
Okay.
But there.
I mean, they did just do the dramatization of, like, some of the play cycles that relate to
it. Right, so, like, the Hollow Crown.
Yes.
Right.
Would work but if you are a staunch Richard III fan, yes, Ricardin, you're not going to like the way that goes for the Richard III part.
No, but the other parts, you know, I think are definitely some Plantagenet hagiography, but, like, the origin of that family with Henry II and Eleanor of Aquitaine is a really, really good, that's a great story.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. Soph and I think one of our earliest bonding points is our Eleanor of Aquitaine obsession.
Yeah.
Started with A Proud Taste for Scarlet and Miniver by E.L. Konigsberg, and continued by A Lion in Winter.
Yes.
I'm a big fan of A Lion in Winter.
It's a classic, classic. So
have
good.
Have you read A Proud Taste for Scarlet and Miniver?
No.
You would love it, Aline.
Yes.
It's ostensibly a children's book, but it's not particularly childish.
No.
And it is Eleanor sitting in heaven, like, reviewing her life as she waits for Henry, her husband, to be sent up from purgatory. He's, like, gonna get reviewed that day. And she's sort of thinking over their life together, and it's so good.
And she's chatting about it with a knight who protected her mother-in-law, Matilda, and I think a priest, like, her confessor.
Mm-hmm.
And just, like, reviewing, you know, her first marriage to the King of France and their eventual divorce. And then she, you know, her incredible romance with Henry and the 12 children that they had. And
oh, for the love of heaven.
Or maybe it was only 11. I can't remember. It was a lot. And it was a big deal to her that, like, when she was with Louis, they had two girls. And when she was with Henry, she immediately had, like, a string of sons, and she felt that, like, was clearly a message from God that marriage was the right one and the previous marriage was a wrong one.
Oh, primogeniture.
So it seems like we should be watching The White Queen, the BBC adaptation of the Philippa Gregory White Queen, because it's about Elizabeth Woodville and Edward IV.
Oh.
Interesting. Interesting.
So okay. I think
I would
maybe we should
into that.
Maybe we should review that.
Okay, we'll take a look for that. Anna wrote down the Konigsberg title, which I still can't remember because there was something about Scarlet, but it's written down so I can get my hands on that.
I haven't read it either.
I will tell you that From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Baisley, Frank Wyler is the entire reason that I spent my 20s in New York. Well, that and Desperately Seeking Susan.
That's a great combination.
Right, isn't it?
I love it.
So we digressed-ish because we're still talking about In Cake of English History. You did tell us, we've all talked about when we first read it.
So I want to do some readings so that people listening to this that haven't read it can get an idea of what it sounds like. Although we are no Derricks.
We are no Derricks. Do you have one of my readings is a note from the actress friend, and one of them is later.
Marta Hallard. I love Marta Hallard.
I do love Marta. And one
Anna
of them
has had a... Oh, go ahead.
No, tell me.
Excuse me, Anna has had a Josephine Tay book as a gift from me for, like, close to... It's probably
almost,
not 10 years.
It's
probably
not
like
10
eight.
Years, but it's like 8 years, and I still need to read it.
But it's one that features Marta really prominently.
Ooh, okay.
So if you liked her, it's set in an artist colony, which is the best kind of mystery. But we'll go back to that in a second. So you have a reading from Marta, and...
So I just discovered that my second reading is Anna's reading. Because I said, why is this bookmark here? And she said, that's my reading. And I said, that's my reading, and showed her my notes.
So,
and so
I guess I'll do that one.
I have to let her read that.
Which one is yours, Anna?
Mine is about Dr. Gardner, the historian who's a scream.
I love that.
It is really, really good. So,
I have a reading, too.
Excellent.
Oh, good. But mine's, like, slightly early. I don't know. It's Marta's...
Mine is pretty early, too.
Oh, wait, when is
mine
yours?
Mine is on page 9.
Okay, go for it.
So, this is a continuing theme in Josephine Tay books, and it's one of my favorite things that she does, is she just throws shade on other authors through proxies. So at the very beginning of the book, Grant is looking at all of the books on his bedside table.
That was
and
a
like
great
hating them
scene.
And there's this one particular description that just gets me every time. The sweat and the furrow was Silas Weekly being earthy and spade conscious all over 700 pages. The situation, to judge from the first paragraph, had not materially changed since Silas's last book. The mother, lying in with her 11th upstairs, the father, laid out after his 9th downstairs, eldest son, lying to the government in the cow shed, eldest daughter, lying with her lover in the hayloft, everyone else, lying low in the barn. The rain dripped from the thatch, and the manure steamed in the midden. Silas never emitted the manure. It was not Silas's fault that its steam provided the only uprising element in the picture. If Silas could have discovered a brand of steam that steamed downwards, Silas would have introduced it.
Oh,
I loved that.
Such a good read.
I have a quote from... So Joe Walton wrote an article about this, about Daughter of Time. And
I'm glad to get Joe Walton in early here, because we are definitely going to be talking about her later.
So she says, it is possible to deduce by the existence of Cold Comfort Farm and the novel described here, The Sweat and the Furrow by Silas Weekly, that there was a whole genre of realistic books about farming and sex and misery. I have read none of those books and only deduce their existence because two different writers parodied them in a way that leads me to see their shadow.
Yeah, she does great. I mean, the Rupert Rouge is also very good. Bells on Their Toes. And just the whole thing, she just, in 2 pages, gives you, like, a cutting overview of what was popular fiction in 1950. It's really 1930 to 1950, and it's so funny. And it's also so funny to look at, I mean, like, this is how someone is going to write about Jonathan Franzen, right?
Yeah.
We hope and pray.
60 years from now, we're only going to know Jonathan Franzen books existed at all because some more trenchant female writer will have satirized them.
This is...
And we'll read that for comedy.
Yeah. I love it.
I'm for it.
I'm writing that down in my vision board right now.
Sophie,
nothing would make me
reading?
Happier. You know, I didn't choose one because I figured everybody else would choose one and that yours would be wonderful.
They mm-hmm. will be, and we're fine. So my reading is a note from Marta, the fancy actress who is in a long-running play in the West End, who is always bringing him sheafs of flowers and tossing flowers from one vase for her own. And
I love that.
Generally just coming in, sweeping in a puff of expensive scent.
I think this is aspirational for Margaret.
Always imagine her being like Kristen Scott Thomas.
Okay.
Yes, yeah. I would say a little Kristen Scott Thomas-y. And just, oh, darling. And
she is highly aspirational for me, yes.
There's no real indication of the nature of their connection. He doesn't seem to be a very posh dude, although he is a gentleman, of course, but they are good friends. She's brought him books, and he has asked her to bring him a book that he's discovered he needs. He had not nearly exhausted the Rose of Raby and the illicit joys of fiction when, next morning about 11, a parcel arrived from Marta containing the more respectable entertainment of history, as recorded by the sainted Sir Thomas. With the book was a note in Marta's large, sprawling writing on Marta's stiff, expensive notepaper. Have to send this instead of bringing it. Frantically busy. Think I have got M.M. to the sticking point, re Blessington. No tea more in any of the bookshops, so tried public library. Can't think why one never thinks of public libraries. Probably because books expected to be soupy. Think this looks quite clean and unsoupy. You get 14 days. Sounds like a sentence rather than a loan. Hope this interest in Crouchback means that the prickles are less nettlish. Till soon, Marta.
Oh, Marta.
So good.
And having embarked on a weeding project of late, some public library books are indeed soupy.
Yeah.
That's a fact.
They are.
But not all.
Not all of them. Not even most of them.
Just enough to make you think, oh, will this book be soupy?
Yes. It is an underlying fear when one seeks out a public library book.
Mm-hmm.
I had one other quote, which is, nothing puts things in perspective as quickly as a mountain.
Did you underline it? Yes. Okay. I'm like, college, why did that stand out to me?
I have it written here, but I had outlined it in 1997 or whenever this was. I forgot to say that I took this class and I read this book. I went to the Portrait Gallery in London and I acquired a Richard III postcard, and I was then thereafter stuck to the wall of my dorm room. Portrait of Richard III. So even between
was it
years,
part of the Scully shrine?
No, it was separate from the Scully shrine. It was near my Xena poster.
Oh, okay.
But if I have pictures of my dorm room and I can see it on the wall, it's very small in comparison to some of the other things. But it was always like right next to my bed because I'm a dork.
An admirer of competent administrators. I don't think that's dorky.
Okay, great. Mm-hmm. Late in the book, he's basically sending this researcher out, and anyone he can find out, to find books on Richard III and then evaluating them critically.
Yeah.
Thomas More gets evaluated most critically.
It's so fascinating to read this in concert with Wolf Hall, which I'm still in the midst of reading.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's definitely on my list here.
That's on my list, too.
Here, Thomas More is initially damned, but then cleared once you find out that the manuscript that has been attributed to him was merely a manuscript he owned and was actually much more likely written by this, like, court schemer who ran afoul of Richard named, John Morton.
Yeah.
But for a brief moment, we get a lot of fury directed at the sainted Thomas More.
Yes. The sainted Sir Thomas.
Yeah. I think he's not that sympathetic in Wolf Hall.
No, he's extraordinarily unsympathetic.
He's
But that's
ghastly.
Radical departure, because Thomas More is very often truly depicted as, like, a saint, a hero.
Yeah, well.
For having briefly stood up to Henry VIII about abandoning the Catholic Church.
So that sounds like the Catholic position to me.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think there's a general favor of anyone who speaks truth to power. And if you look at Henry, you can't argue that he wasn't someone who deserved to have some truth spoken to him.
True. Someone is licking my calf. Okay.
But yeah.
It's not me.
Wolf Hall is not pro Thomas More.
No, not at all.
It's very, very anti-Thomas More.
Yeah.
It's pro Thomas Cromwell, who everyone thinks is like a heartless toady, and very anti Thomas More in a way that is extraordinarily persuasive.
Yeah,
it's very
satisfying.
It's super satisfying. And, you know, skipping ahead to Reader's Advisory, I definitely, if someone was looking for more historical reclamation projects, I would say, have you read Wolf Hall?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
Okay. I'm glad we're in accord.
Yeah, I think that they go really well together. You know, she says of The Rose of Raby, which is this historical fiction novel that Grant picks up as part of his research, that it's history with dialogue added, and like none of the like forsooth my lady hi thee so on and so forth, just like pretty direct modern speech and nothing very fussy about it. I think that that's also a very good description of Wolf Hall's whole aesthetic, and also sort of the approach to history that Josephine Tay is indirectly advocating for in A Daughter of Time, which is like history with your good sense engaged, and history where you assume that people in past times, despite having different, you know, technology and some different values, still acted roughly the same way we do now.
Yeah. So my quote is the evaluation of the book The Life and Reign of Richard III by someone named James Gardner. Dr. Gardner obstinately believed Richard to be a murderer, but since he was a writer, honest, learned, and according to his lights, impartial, it was not in him to suppress facts. The spectacle of Dr. Gardner trying to make his facts fit his theory was the most entertaining thing in gymnastics that Grant had witnessed for some time. Dr. Gardner acknowledged, with no apparent sense of incongruity, Richard's great wisdom, his generosity and his courage, his ability, his charm, his popularity, and the trust that he inspired even in his beaten enemies, and in the same breath reported his vile slander of his mother and his slaughter of two helpless children. Tradition says, said the worthy doctor, and solemnly reported the horrible tradition and subscribed to it. There was nothing mean or paltry in his character, according to the doctor, but he was a murderer of innocent children. Even his enemies had confidence in his justice, but he murdered his own nephews. His integrity was remarkable, but he killed for gain.
A classic example of two things can be true. Mm-hmm. Except they weren't.
This book is one that I like more every time I read it. Because once you deal with the bait and switch of being told it's a mystery novel and then receiving a book that's basically about like scholarly pursuits in a hospital, once you're through that shock, if you can revisit it, just how sharply all of the characters are drawn and the incredible quirks of the dialogue and description are so good. I love Brent Carradine, and I love his like weird dad Carradine III, mm-hmm. who's ferociously American and hates kings, but like also like loves that he's Carradine III and sort of like wants a throne of his own. It's just such a recognizable type.
Yes, definitely. I have another article here which we will link, but this person is talking about the pluses and minuses of the book, you know, that it's not a mystery. There's no sense of jeopardy, he says, and that there are a lot of names that can be overwhelming. But then he says, the manipulation and deployment of historical research is breathtaking. Just the pace at which she deploys information, like they sort of like hit a wall here, but then they find something else and they move forward. And it actually does seem like there's something at stake.
Yes.
And it's exciting.
And you have setbacks and leap forwards.
Yeah.
Like one of the big things that they point out as damning of the theory that Richard killed his nephews is that there's no contemporary account of it that they right. can find. And then they find a contemporary account by a monk in this certain part of England, and you get a setback. And then they figure out that like that monk was on creepy John Morton's way out of town after he'd been exiled by Richard. And it's just fascinating and suspenseful.
It is. I think it's more suspenseful than you would suspect a sitting in the hospital room reading reports from the 15th century would be.
Yes.
Yeah, especially when, you know, the Grant has literally nothing else to do. It's not like a modern convalescence from an injury of that type where he would be, you know, immediately.
Watch Netflix.
Well, I was going to say immediately in physical therapy. Like he wouldn't be in the main hospital for as long as he was. They would try to transfer him to a rehab facility ASAP. He would almost certainly have Netflix as well. But like they would be keeping him busy. They would be getting him up out of the bed. They wouldn't be worried that, you know, too much emotional investment in something like this would be detrimental to his recovery. You know, I'm sure, in fact, that would be encouraged. But he also wouldn't need someone like Brent Carradine, who's so delightful. He'd be looking this stuff up on his own. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably the suspense was even greater for readers when the book was originally published, because now, like, archaeologists have found Richard III's bones. And we know for a fact that he did not have a hunchback, and his arm, he had the use of
they
both of his arms.
They found it in, like, a Tesco parking lot.
Yep.
Like 4 years ago.
Yeah. And so they know things like...
He did have scoliosis, so it would have been noticeable, but it wasn't like he was wildly...
He wasn't very much like the Richard portrayed in Richard III, and then also portrayed in The Heir Affair.
Right. And I mean, he couldn't have been. Like, you could not be a medieval warrior king and unable to ride a horse and wield a broadsword. Like, that just, that wasn't possible. So
poppycock.
Yes. Tony Pandy.
Tony Pandy.
Oh, Tony Pandy. It is very satisfying when Brent is like, you don't want to write a book, do you? He couldn't believe that maybe he might get the opportunity and that it would be feasible for a Scotland Yard detective to want to write a historical book in
obviously
the first place.
Those two would be such a great team, though.
Oh, they would.
That would be great.
But yeah, the whole conceit of Tony Pandy and then all of the examples that get brought up within the book of it is so fun to read as a history enthusiast.
Yeah. It's fun to read, and it's also chilling.
Well, it's frustrating and infuriating and chilling, definitely. And I was shouting at it for someone to do it for all of the women for all of time.
Well, this is one of the things that's interesting, is that the examples that are brought forward are like very 1950s examples, right? Where it's like, you know, those strikers, everybody thinks were a subject of violent suppression. Well, they're actually just fine. And they were all jerks anyways. Right? It's things like that where now... when you think of actual examples of suppressed or altered history, it's rarely like, well, gosh, weren't we too hard on big, powerful white men?
Right.
But Sophie, you wanted to say something?
Oh, yeah. I was just saying, thinking about it in our present historical and political context, you know, the person occupying the White House is a person who likes to invent things out of whole cloth that he then repeats and repeats and repeats, and so people start to accept it as fact. I mean, it's exactly what this is. Like, even if they have some question as to whether it's true or not, or what they're reading is debunking it, the more it's repeated, the more it just sort of settles into your mind as being true.
Ugh.
You know, like, I mean, the only thing that I knew about Richard III when I read this book and it originally was like, my horse, my kingdom for a horse. And, you know, that he was a bad man. And I didn't know the story, like the allegations of murder. I don't think I knew that until I started reading the book. And I thought, oh, ugh, like, how's he going to get him out of this pickle? It seems pretty hopeless. But I think to answer Anna's question from the very beginning, how do you prove a negative? Like, you can't, but if you can sow enough seeds of doubt, like, that's, to me, that's the victory.
I mean, it is sort of incredible that today it's still taught that Richard killed the boys in the tower.
Right, right. I mean, that is still definitely the historical assumption to the degree that Americans learn about this history at all.
Right. I'd love to know how much Marcus ever learned about the War of the Roses. Sophie's husband and prince consort is British.
Yes, I think he would say that his knowledge of the situation is pretty much what Grant's knowledge of it is pre-investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I will let you know what if little G happens to take British history sometime, I'll keep an eye out.
I mean, I never took a course in it. Like, it was, I'm thinking about the one like modern world history course I took in my entire education, actually. And that was like, it was a year-long elective in high school, but it was modern history. Like, I don't think we even picked up until the 1700s.
Oh, there's almost no reason for anyone other than British students to learn about the War of the Roses, but it's a completely parochial dispute. You know, at that point in time, England wasn't nearly as powerful as it became by Henry's day.
Right.
And it's just two warring factions bickering back and forth over the crown.
For a long time.
For a long time. And you guys were scoffing when I said the Game of Thrones, but Game of Thrones is like very directly inspired by the War of the Roses, just so people know that I'm not just coming out of nowhere with that reference.
I was a history minor, and I don't like American history, so I took early modern England, and I took early modern France, and I took Tudor Stuart England, and I wish there had been like a Plantagenet course, because I totally would have taken that, but in my tiny college there was not.
Your different tiny Ohio college.
Right.
My slightly
larger, less elite tiny Ohio college.
Which was it, the College of Worcester?
No, I went to Denison. It's about half an hour, 40 minutes away from Kenyon.
Yeah.
Sophie actually did a writing program at Kenyon and decided that rural Ohio was not for her.
Yeah, I decided no thank you, hard pass.
Which is not unlike what you decided about Kenyon, which is you and your dad drove through Gambier twice?
At least twice. Maybe three times.
At least twice.
Looking for it.
Before you even realized you'd gone through it. Because it's less a town and more an intersection.
Also, I went on the college tour the next day, and the story about feuding in the English department that was described to me by the tour guide was not unlike the Wars of the Roses. And I thought...
You've never told me about this.
I don't know if I want to go be a major in a department where everyone seems to hate each other.
Everyone's fighting all the time.
It just doesn't seem like fun, does it?
Yeah, and then Denison gave me a much bigger scholarship. So there we are.
Yeah, and the rest is history.
And for all of you listeners who have approaching college-age children, Denison is on the late great Lauren Pope's list of colleges that change lives.
I think so is Kenyon.
You just can't let it rest, can you, Margaret?
No.
I just wanted to throw it out there. It's a great school. I loved going there.
I know. And I have liked some Kenyon alums.
Denison seems great too. I'm friends with Denison alums. You, Anna, Angie.
Yeah, okay. We could not overcome Kenyon in academic or swimming rivalry.
Well, but who can overcome Kenyon in swimming rivalry?
No one. They are usually champions.
We have tiny Slovak countries Olympians on our swim team.
It's very weird. Anyway, we may be digressing somewhat from Daughter of Time.
Yes, we are.
Let's try to sum up so we can move on to Reader's Advisory.
Sure.
Allie, do you think that you'll ever read it again, or would you be interested in reading any other Josephine Tay?
I might like to see Inspector Alan Grant in action.
As opposed to inaction.
I have not read any Agatha Christie as a lifelong mystery reader. I am...
Wow. What? How did you do that? I started when I was like 10.
I was reading romances when I was 10.
Oh, true, true. Okay.
I started reading mysteries when I was a little bit older and very into Grit.
Yep.
Robert B. Parker, urban sort of contemporary mysteries. I don't go in much for historical mysteries except some... which that would be really a huge digression. So I am not a scholar of the golden age of mysteries.
Have you read Dorothy Sayers?
I have read one Dorothy Sayers.
Okay.
Yeah, I know, right? Isn't that just appalling? And I call myself a mystery lover. I like them. I've liked them fine. I like historical fiction. I think I could probably read another Inspector Grant novel. I think there might be other stuff that I would read.
Well, we have a recommendation for that.
We do. We'll be in there shortly. This is the first time I had read it since college. I enjoyed the progression, and it made me, of course, want to read the book that Margaret gave me 8 years ago. Naturally.
I highly recommend that you do.
But it also made me want to, like, learn more about the Plantagenets and the War of the Roses and... either by reading or by finding a really nice nonfiction audiobook to like sort of listen to and have it percolate as I go about my business, or watching some kind of silly mini series like The White Queen or even Rain, just to get in the flavor of, you know, costume yeah. drama of that sort of 14th, 15th century era.
Yep.
So that's what this has inspired me to do.
Mm-hmm. That's a good thing for it to inspire you to do. This just makes me mad that there isn't more Josephine Tay on audiobook, because that's how I do most of my rereading. Yeah. Right. It's been a really long time since I've reread the vast majority of her books. Brat Farrar, which is also available on Audible and easily available, therefore, on audiobook, is terrific. And it's a standalone, and it's very Hitchcockian in its bones. I love it fiercely. Yeah. So I listened to that one a bunch, and I've got The Daughter of Time. But my favorite Josephine Tay is the one, Anna, that you own, To Love and Be Wise, which is investigating the disappearance of a prominent photographer in like the fancy village where all the foremost artists go and live. So like all of the authors whose books Grant doesn't want to read live in this same vacation village. So you actually get to meet Silas Weekly, and you get to meet Rupert Rouge and all those guys, and it's great. But it's been probably, I don't think I've reread that since I gave it to Anna. So now I just desperately want to. Yeah, that's my chief takeaway. I want to reread that very badly.
Do you want to segue us, Sophie, into, because it sounds like you have some reader's advisory suggestions for us.
Oh, we do.
I do. Yeah, so I would say my big takeaway from this book is that Richard III was a super badass Hufflepuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just came away thinking, oh, what a great administrator he was. And he was only 32 when he died.
And super loyal, too.
Yeah, just like loyal and competent and full of proper brotherly affection.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he was a murdering, monstrous uncle. So it makes me want to reread Wolf Hall, that book, and its sequel, Bring Up the Bodies, and their presumed eventual sequel.
I think
will be called.
I think it does have a publication date. I will check on it.
Okay. Please do. That's very exciting. As we've mentioned before, The Hollow Crown is a really great series. It's all the Shakespeare historical plays, minus, I don't think they did King John. That's a pretty minor one. That goes yeah. much further back to the earlier Plantagenet days. But they start with Henry IV, Henry V, Henry VI. They do Richard III. I don't think they go beyond that, though.
No, I think that's it.
But they're very good. The Princes in the Tower, which I mentioned previously, by Alison Weir, who's one of Britain's foremost historical writers on this period. And then I had some watch-alikes. Oh, wait, I had a couple more read-alikes. One is a series of books by Sharon K. Penman about the people who preceded the Plantagenets.
Oh, good.
So that's got the first one is The Sun in Splendor. And I think that one is about Matilda.
Oh, Matilda.
And then there's a bunch about a Welsh king, which they're very, very compelling. If you want to go even further back, I feel like I recommend this on every podcast, but it's so good. It's always germane. Hild by Nicola Griffith.
Yep.
Yay.
That book is so amazing. So that one takes place in really, really early Britain, like in the 500s or 600s, I want to say. And it is about a girl who is the younger daughter of a minor regional king. And when he dies, her mother basically kind of like flirts and schemes her way into the court of her uncle, who's the new king. And she relies on Hild's ability to intuit what people are worried about. And she sort of spins that ability into what could or could not be skill as a seer or a prophet. And that little girl winds up growing up to be the historical St. Hilda of Whitby, for whom St. Hilda's College at Oxford is named.
Ah.
Do we want to do all read-alikes and then come back around for watch-alikes, or?
I think we can mix and match. The update on Hilary Mantel's third book is that it's called The Mirror and the Light, but there's no date.
Okay. Well, we will live in hope.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
My watch-alikes are The Usual Suspects.
Excellent.
Interesting.
Which features a minor character restricted to a bed, mostly shouting, Kaiser Soze! while someone attempts to draw Kaiser Soze. But that's one where you've got a detective trying to put together this mass murder, trying to figure out who the real perpetrator is. And it, similar to The Daughter of Time, it sort of goes round and around and around about the same limited set of facts. And in the case of The Daughter of Time, you have this limitation because you're investigating a 400-year-old murder mystery. And so the documents from that era, many of them are destroyed. And what remains is difficult to access or written in an impenetrable language or is fragmentary or just impeachable for some reason. And in the case of The Usual Suspects, most of the people involved are dead. So there's this one survivor who's telling the story and you have to decide, you know, what's reliable, what's not. So that's a really good one. Also, The Singing Detective starring Michael Gambon, which is another one where the detective is restricted to a sick bed. It's much more hallucinatory than this one, but it's similar vein. And then last one is a historical romance set not exactly in this period. It's slightly after. And that is The Great Lady Jane, starring Helena Bonham Carter and Carrie Elwes.
Oh, Carrie.
Oh my God, I loved that movie. I had
I had
the page from 17 magazine when the movie came out torn out and posted in my locker forever. It's probably in a file upstairs somewhere.
I salute you.
So I endorse that one for sure. Margaret, what are your additional read-alikes and watch-alikes?
The read-alikes that I'm going to put forward, I mean, read all of Josephine Tay's novels. They're all great, even The Franchise Affair, which is very imperfect, starting with To Love and Be Wise. But the ones that I'm sort of shocked Sophie didn't mention, because they're our shared favorites, are the series that Joe Walton wrote inspired by these, which, Aline, I might actually recommend you starting with before you start with any other Josephine Tay novels. So they're the Small Change trilogy, and it's Farthing, Haypenny, and Half a Crown. Mm-hmm. And they are working off of the fact that in Brat Farrar, one of the characters travels freely on the continent during a time when World War II should have been ongoing. And inspired by that, Joe Walton creates just an alternate reality England where after Dunkirk, Britain actually surrendered to the Nazis and called a truce, saying basically, like, we'll stay on our side of the channel and you can have everything on yours. And it depicts the way that Britain starts to shift into fascism through three mysteries set a couple years apart, all linked by the same detective, who's very much like Alan Grant. And one of the interesting things about Alan Grant is that he is never clearly coupled with any women in a way that now seems kind of suggestive. And one of the ways that Joe Walton has taken that is that the main detective in these novels is queer and has a partner who's also, you know, his servant.
Whoa.
And he's hiding that in a country where that's still illegal, although not prosecuted for people of a certain class. So that's like a really interesting starting point, and it tweaks everything just enough and so well. She gets all the same sort of like economy and pith of characterization that Josephine Tay has, the same sort of captured speech patterns and dialogue, but with just enough interesting extra stuff going on that they're remarkable. So those are great to read, and they're also really good to listen to.
Oh, I should do that. So I read Farthing?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
I enjoyed it. I haven't read the other. I think at the time I didn't know it was a trilogy. And I have since read other things by Jo Walton, so I
She's so good. She's uniformly great.
Yeah.
And writes so many different things.
Yeah, that sounds like something that I could probably get into. I've been trying to find my access point to Jo Walton. So I will add that.
What's particularly fun about these books is that they alternate between close third person perspective, like what you see in Josephine Tay when you're with the detective, and a female first person narration that changes from book to book. And those female characters are all super, super, super interesting. And the distinctness of their voices is really terrific.
Thanks. Anna, what are yours?
Wait.
Do you
have more?
Yeah. Do you have watch-alikes or anything?
No. I just have those bad boys.
Okay. Excellent. So I love all Elizabeth Peters books anyway. whether they are set in Victorian Egypt or... Elizabeth Peters has several series of mysteries featuring different heroines. And Jacqueline Kirby, if I recall correctly, is a former librarian.
Yes.
And The Murders of Richard III is one of the books in her series. And the description says, in a remote English manor house, modern admirers of the much maligned King Richard III, one of Shakespeare's most extraordinary villains, are gathered for a grand weekend of dress-up and make-believe murder. But the fun ends when the make-believe turns more sinister and deadly. Jacqueline Kirby, an American librarian on hand for the festivities, suddenly finds herself in the center of strange, dark doings and racing to untangle a murderous puzzle before history repeats itself in exceptionally bloody ways.
I want to be described as an American librarian on hand for the festivities.
Yeah, for sure. I haven't read it for a long time.
I feel like you've got a very realistic chance at that, Ali.
But I love Jacqueline and I love Elizabeth Peters, so I may need to reread that. I had The Princes in the Tower. I had Wolf Hall on my list. I had The Hollow Crown on my list. In terms of rehabilitation, I was thinking about Hamilton as a good listen alike.
That's very interesting.
Because of the work it does for people like Aaron Burr, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Since he is the person through which the story is told, I think you end up feeling sympathetic toward him and toward Hamilton, even though neither of them are particularly spotless characters. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to put that forward as a possible reader's advisory. I do not know and have not read any good historical nonfiction on Richard III. There is one called Richard III, The Great Debate. There are documentaries with titles such as Richard III, The King in the Car Park, and Richard III, Martyr or Monster. And I feel like we should get one of those and watch it with Little G and see what he thinks. There is...
I'd be interested in the Nova episode on the excavation, for sure.
Yeah, and it looks like... someone named Philippa Langley, she's the historian who discovered his grave.
Uh-huh.
And a screenwriter. That's interesting. Huh. So she spearheaded a Looking for Richard project, and that's what resulted in the discovery of his grave in that Tesco car park. And she's trying, or was trying, I think this was written in 2014. There's a piece in the, or no, written in 2015. Okay. There's a piece in The Independent who's trying to once and for all figure out what happened to Edward V and his brother Richard, the Duke of York. Interesting. So I don't know what the outcome, if any, has been. Like, she may still be working on it.
Hmm.
But that's she says, this is a pure research project and it's exciting in that we can go into it with a focus on this particular mystery. Teaming up with professional cold case investigators, some of who work with the police on unsolved murders.
Okay. Hmm.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me.
Do you have any watch-alikes, Anna?
I have two more read-alikes. Oh, sorry. One is an Inspector Morse book.
Ooh.
By Colin Dexter called The Wench is Dead. And it says, Inspector Morse, recovering from an ulcer in Oxford's Radcliffe Hospital, comes across an old book recounting a sensational murder case that took place in Oxford 100 years earlier. Convinced that the two men hanged for the crime were innocent, Morse sets out from the confines of his bed to prove it. Sounds familiar.
Yeah.
It does.
And there's another one called To Prove a Villain by Guy Orgy. I don't know. He could be French. Townsend. And that there is no description for. It merely says a solid amateur sleuth tracking a killer down mean streets and campus pathways proves that academics can be both clever and human. A well-aimed shot at history mystery buffs who seek to revise the reputation of Richard III. So.
Nice.
Yeah, right.
I remembered two things. One, I wanted to say that I collect authorial alter egos. And Josephine Taze comes up in here, and I don't think you ever see her again. But it's Madeline March, who's the playwright that Marta Hallard is trying to convince to write a show for her.
Okay.
Who you subsequently find out, just like after Marta has finally got her convinced, she instead decides that she has to write one of her dreadful little mystery novels. And that is a direct spoof on Josephine Taze herself, who was also a playwright, in addition to being a mystery novelist. And I forgot to say that there's a series of books by Nicola Upson where Josephine Taze herself is the detective. I haven't read them yet.
I haven't read them either. It was on my list, too.
But they're well-reviewed. And then there's also a series of novels by a woman named Sarah Stewart Taylor that are about a Harvard professor who does art history by way of studying funerary arts. And they start with Oh, Artful Death. And they're great in terms of, like, there's a modern mystery that she's solving that is connected to some art historical artifact and a historical mystery. And so you get to work in sort of the tandem fields and then have everything come together at the end.
We have a copy of Oh, Artful Death. It's right next to the Josephine Tay that Margaret gave me.
I wonder how you could have gotten any of
She's, oh, and it looks like she writes for children as well.
She does.
She published a book for McSweeney's called The Expeditioners and the Treasure of Drowned Men's Canyon.
Okay.
And under normal circumstances, I could look at those books with great charity in my heart, but I have been waiting for her to write more Sweeney St. George mystery novels for almost 8 years, and she keeps disappointing me. More than 8 years, I think 10 years since she wrote the last one, and it's not because she's done. She could conceivably write more Sweeney St. George. There's still so much story to happen.
How about you, Ellen? Do you have
any watch-alikes?
No, I had the ones I mentioned.
Okay. I mentioned this in our previous episode because in our last episode I was obsessed with The Daughter of Time, and I said that it had a Rear Window thing going on.
Oh, true.
Mm-hmm.
And
very true.
This is a movie that I love. It's a Hitchcock movie starring James Stewart and Grace Kelly. If you don't know it well, I highly recommend it. I had the great good fortune to live in an apartment building that stared at the back of an apartment building that was laid out almost identically to that setup when I was a younger person. And I did not witness any murders. I just saw some pretty spectacular pot plants. But that whole feeling of things beyond your reach and not being able to have a hand in fixing or solving or dealing with them was something that I felt in the reading of Daughter of Time. From another standpoint of historical epic tales, there's all of the stuff that we would like the historical fiction. We love the Tudors. We love the Lion in Winter. We've talked a lot. We've mentioned a lot of glancing things. It made me think of Dorothy Dunnett, who I have not read, but who wrote the Lymond Chronicles and The House of Niccolo, which are sweeping epic series.
Oh my god,
series.
So...
Have you read these?
Sorry. My mom. I have all of my mom's copies of them.
Okay.
Because she was deeply into historical fiction, romance. And I read the first of the Lyman Chronicles. It was great. I offered it as a read-alike to Wolf Hall, so you could slot it right in there. It's
okay.
A similar time period, but it's set in Scotland.
Right.
And it is denser in the way that they sort of, like, fling off references, and if you don't get them, too bad. there is a book, like a companion book that you can get to help with that. But
okay.
But The first book also has a fantastic sword fight in it.
Okay, so still not sure if it's a match as I've not read it, but I'm always looking for a lady having perpetrated something on this order. Margaret mentioned Game of Thrones, which is a spectacular series that is very lush and is very accessible, especially since you can watch it now. Mm-hmm. And I feel like Dorothy Dunnett was a precursor to those in many ways. Mm-hmm. And that is pretty much all I have, except, you know, the things that we've talked about. I think that someone with an interest in the golden age of mystery might want to flirt with Agatha or Colin Dexter, which Anna mentioned, and there are dozens of others where it's sort of a rarefied air that is very different from what we are accustomed to now in mysteries that are written in this century. I thought about, it's not a cold case kind of vibe, but both Val McDermid and Tana French have done mysteries that are solved 25 years after they happen.
Mm-hmm.
That can also have a feeling of, it's not 400 years, but it seems like it's long over with, and it isn't.
It's still not over.
No.
But I definitely will never like Thomas More or Henry VII.
No.
What about Cromwell?
I'm fine with him, mostly.
Hilary Mantel is a very persuasive writer.
She is. Also, whoever adapted them for television.
Very persuasive.
I think.
Good job.
No, she was involved in the Broadway.
She was involved in the, because we read it for our Reader's Advisory Round Table, and I think I checked the credits when we watched it, and
so
that should give anyone listening to this far more things than they can consume.
Yes.
But I'm sure we will come up with more as soon as we hang up. Let us move to musical obsessions. I'm going to send it straight to Sophie.
Do you want me to go now or do you want me to go last? Because they're kind of the same thing. And I feel like if I start with one, they're just going to...
Okay.
Yeah.
Margaret, do you have a musical obsession for us?
Yes. So the weather has finally turned to bare leg appropriate weather. I agree with you guys in your mourning for spring. But I'll take windows open weather anytime. And I have a ritual. When it gets like this, I play a particular album by Camera Obscura and a particular song by Camera Obscura. And so the album and the song are both named Let's Get Out of This Country. Yay. And 11 years ago, this May, I fell in love with this song while I was studying abroad, which one? The broad city of Exeter in England. Like, I've only been emboldened to start making that joke out loud, that joke that happens in my head every single time I say studied abroad, because our friend Andrew makes that joke every single time you say it. Studied abroad, which one?
This is good, because I am definitely going to be adding it to my arsenal of jokes that I never miss when we're supposed to go straight through an intersection and I can't, and Anna gets to work and she has to turn all the computers on and I'm like, yeah, you do.
So every day.
Studying abroad is going to be added. Thank you very, very much.
I'll let Andrew know that he's enriched your life. But it's a really wonderful song, and it is about that, like, itchy feeling you get at the very, very end of winter when you're completely ready for it to be spring. And it's about wanting to leave the dreary city that you're in and, like, take a vacation in the British countryside. And it's great. So that is my musical obsession, is Let's Get Out of This Country by Camera Obscura. The whole album is amazing, but that particular song is the first song of theirs I fell absolutely in love with. And they are maybe my favorite band.
On a down note, my musical obsession is Fall Apart Again by Brandi Carlile, which I heard today in the car and I just wanted to hear it more times, so I thought I'd stick it on the list where it will come up repeatedly.
That's a great way to solve that problem.
Right? How about you, Eileen?
So my musical obsession is our Greatest City in the World playlist that we put together because we went to New York last weekend, and we solicited suggestions from our followers. Thank you very much for the contributions y'all submitted. We put together a 52 song playlist that does not include Frank Sinatra, and
darn right it doesn't.
For the purposes of Spotify availability, I am going to put the Ryan Adams version of Welcome to New York on our Musical Obsessions playlist.
But when we listen to it, we'll know that we really want to be hearing the other version.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Sophie, take it away.
Oh boy. All right. Hi, everybody. my musical obsession, if for those of you who either follow me on Twitter or read Two Bossy Dames, you'll already know that my musical obsession this week is Sign of the Times by Harry Styles.
The crowd goes wild.
And it sounds like three of the four of us have only listened to it once.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Which is fine. I hope you will listen to it more. Because I think it has a lot to give, and I'm not one of those people who's listening to it on a constant loop all day long, although I honor those who are doing it. That's a great goal, but it's such an emotional journey every time I hear it that I can't do that. And that leads into my overall obsession, which is, again, Harry Styles. So I have written down some appeal factors. Because I approach everything through like a cultural recommendations or cultural advisory kind of way. And I'm going to start with him being an excellent student and writer of music, because it became clear to me as a young old who got into One Direction in a big way, I don't know, like 8 or 9 weeks ago.
Wait,
what?
Very fresh obsession.
I was going to say, our obsession with One Direction is Aline introduced them to me like 3 years ago now.
Right. Yeah. So I knew who they were since their first single, What Makes You Beautiful. Right. And
you
remember thinking,
aware of their work.
I was definitely aware of their work. And I was like, I like their music. I am familiar with these three songs. I think these three songs are really good. And then I was sitting in my car after driving my daughter to school, and on the way home, their song Story of My Life came on the radio. Yeah. And I was like, let me listen to that song. I have not heard this song in a while. And it was shortly after the inauguration. Emotions were running high.
Yeah.
And that song, like, it's a perfectly acceptable ballad. It is not like the greatest song ever written, but when I heard it in that context, this song that is just all about like emotional attachment and caregiving and like really being invested in the emotional well-being of another person, I was sobbing in my driveway and immediately jumped into a group DM situation that had been going on for several weeks that our friend Shaz, who lives
in Alicia, both have been on the 1D train.
Oh yeah, since forever.
Yeah.
Just following the election, Shaz had started this group DM with a large group of us, just sort of saying like, "Hey, I know things are really terrible, and I just wanted you to know that I'm thinking about you."
She lives in Malaysia.
Yeah.
Right, though.
Yeah.
In Malaysia. And she just reached out to us to just be like, "Hey, I just wanted you to know that somebody else in another country sees what you're going through and like values what you're doing to push back against your terrible president."
Yeah. So when I said, "Hey, this is what's happening in my emotions today," the two of them were like, "Wait, are you talking about that One Direction song?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And that is where it began. So
my favorite fact in Sophie's early days of obsession with One Direction is that shortly after this conversation happened, the girls talked her into getting the This Is Us documentary.
Okay.
I'm saying that right, Soph, right?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. And she rented it on Amazon. She bought it on Amazon. And a couple days later, her husband was like, "I think Nell has gotten the password to our Amazon Prime." She's got to this out. I think she bought this One Direction documentary. And Sophie was like, "Nope.
No, baby, that was me."
That was your adult wife.
And he gave me this look like, "Do I even know you?" And I said, I immediately shouted, self-care!
Marcus is a very open and loving person. You know, he's not a raucous dinosaur. I mean, he's not a raucous dinosaur.
He's a little bit of a raucous dinosaur. He's also
is raucous.
He's extremely indulgent, I would say.
But he understands the value of our poptimism.
Yes, that is true. He does not share in it, but he understands what it's for. Anyway, I'm sorry, people who are listening. You are the true indulgent ones, because I haven't even really gotten around to telling you what's happening. Okay, I'm just going to summarize really briefly now. The new song is a almost 6-minute space rock emotional opus about maybe the apocalypse, maybe a dead friend, maybe the end of a romantic relationship. We don't know. It could be any of those things or something else entirely. It's being played on pop radio right now. There's a radio edit that's like 4 minutes long.
I was going to say, hopefully it has been edited for length.
No, it has been. However, top 40 stations are playing the full 6-minute version on purpose.
Okay.
It is doing well. It includes elements of the following songs. David Bowie's 5 Years, which is another tremendous emotional epic about the end of the world. The Flaming Lips' Do You Realize? XO by Beyonce. And Purple Rain by Prince.
Beatles... What's the one I was thinking of?
Hey, Jude?
Nope.
Different one?
Carry On.
Sure. Anyway, I think that's kind of amazing that someone who has been previously known for creating beautiful pop confections, although I would say like on their last two albums, One Direction definitely leaned a little more heavily on their like favorite classic rock.
Yes, they had a definite Fleetwood Mac vibe here and there.
Very strong Fleetwood Mac vibe. There's some Eagles, some Beatles, some Kinks, some Simon and Garfunkel in there. There's a lot. But I think that this is a really interesting artistic statement from Young Master Styles, who also is a tremendous speller, is good at baking. I'm really enjoying his transformation into a classic British weirdo. Like... Mm-hmm. I will not be surprised if in 10 years he's like retired to the country to run an organic apiary. Like that just seems like that would be really on brand him. Yeah. Also, I super enjoy his utterly wild stage persona, which contains so many multitudes, including but not limited to the following: dad jokes, concern for his fans' well-being. Like anytime he sees, they mostly tour in the summer, and so people get hot and like overheated and dehydrated.
Yeah, they do.
And you know, he's known to hand out bottles of water and bananas so that people can replenish their potassium, which is really sweet.
What a gentleman.
Yes, but also has this, like, you know, Beyonce's stage persona, Sasha Fierce. He kind of has a version of that too, which a lot of people refer to as him being a stage I will send you a Twitter thread that some wonderful fan, God bless fans, developed that is a different look at him, for sure. It's very interesting. Anyway, I just super enjoy One Direction, and I'm very excited for Harry Styles. He's going to be on Saturday Night Live this week as we record this. There's going to be a new song. You are a young old, I wrote a brief primer on getting involved with him and all the things that he's about.
A brief and highly persuasive primer.
Highly persuasive. That's actually been like my favorite thing, is how many people have emailed me or tweeted me and saying like, I didn't think I cared about him, but I do now.
Well, and Harry Styles is really working with you too in terms of like releasing this particular song, which is such a departure from what One Direction is best known for to adults. And such a direct appeal to many things adults like listening to, even independent of charming stage antics and wonderful Tumblr tags.
Very true.
I did figure out that it was Across the Universe that it reminds me of.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
I have also enjoyed the Blast You, Sophie, Making Me Care About Harry Styles tweets that I have seen coming across the transom. They have made me very amazing. Happy.
It makes me really glad. It's great to have sort of a new litmus test for when people ask me what Two Bossy Dames is about. And I have to sort of describe it in a way that does justice to both, like, the high frivolity and the high academia that we like to engage in. And my go-to was always, well, we've done long-form takes on brutalist architecture and the challenges of historic preservation and how it relates to nostalgia, and also 1,989 words on Taylor Swift's 1989. Right. And I feel like now I can update it to say, and also a young old's introduction to being obsessed with Harry Styles from One Direction.
Yep.
This is perfect. Thanks, Harry.
Mm-hmm. And Sophie.
I have a contemporary friend from my baby librarian days who has been obsessed with One Direction since long before I even thought about looking up their songs on YouTube, and has attended all of the shows when they did a week's run at Madison Square Garden and so on. And
that's impressive.
She is impressive. She is truly, truly impressive. And my hat is off to her for giving me the strength to consider being interested in One Direction, because I have nervousness about being a not very young old and having interest in
being a young old is all about attitude. It's not necessarily about
morally
age.
What was that tweet you had today, Ellie?
My dad joke one?
No.
Oh, no. I said on Twitter today that I don't like septum piercings, but want to pierce my eyebrow years old.
Yeah. That seems completely accurate.
So that's where yeah. I am.
I also don't like septum piercings.
Oh, really?
No, me neither.
See, I see them as a thing that is exclusive to the under 30 set.
Well, you also work next door to Smith College.
I do work next door to Smith College.
Also, no one in this phone call is under 30.
This is true.
That's true.
Oh, okay.
I will be 32 in about 5 weeks.
That's right. I just saw that on the calendar. We have to get ready for that.
Yeah.
okay. So, well, then I will check with the under 30 set. I know a couple of them and see if what the demographic is for that particular one. But yes, I'm a not very young old, and that's where I stand on piercing.
So, FYI.
Is that your obsession this week?
Maybe it should be. Did I do a musical obsession? Yes,
no,
I did.
Oh my God. We need to wrap this up. Clearly. We do need to wrap this up.
So, Margaret, do you have a regular obsession? We're going to call Harry Sophie's musical and regular obsession.
Yes. Yes, I'm done.
They moved into that.
My regular obsession. So for my podcast Appointment Television, we are currently banking episodes in preparation for one of our hosts giving birth to a baby. I anticipate.
Wait. She's giving birth to a baby, you say?
Yep.
Okay.
See, the dad
baby not girl a home appliance. Back. So, to do this, one of the things that we've done is we've squashed in an extra TV book club, which is where we pick out a TV show that's streaming somewhere and we watch it in a set number of doses, and we discuss it on the show in a way that our listeners can listen along with. So we've banked a whole unreleased TV book club on this incredible Australian sitcom called Please Like Me that's streaming on Hulu. And to describe its charms for you, I need to reference the existence of a very, very funny series of comedy videos on YouTube called Disappointing Gay Best Friend. And they are... they are about none of the people involved with Disappointing Gay Best Friend are involved with this, but it is just a crucial reference point.
Okay.
It is a girl who is very stereotypical, like a straight white girl who has a very stereotypical idea of what a gay best friend should be, and then like an actual gay man, and they're 30 seconds long, and she'll just rattle it off. She'll be like, oh my God, we're gonna go to a gay bar, I want to make out with at least 4 boys, and like I'm just like a Cosmo bitch. Like, I'm gonna have so many Cosmos. What did you drink, Tyler? And Tyler will just be like, bourbon. And then he'll, like, open like an Updike novel. And that's the end of the video. And then it'll go, disappointing gay best friend. So what I would say is that in our culture, we have not spent enough time with the disappointing gay best friends of the world. And that Please Like Me is a series that is about, you know, a young man who's just at the very beginning of the series realizes that he's gay when his girlfriend breaks up with him saying, I'm pretty sure you're gay. And it's the early process of him coming to terms with that. And he's just like an incredibly and astoundingly funny and weird dude. And the writing of the show is so sharp and on point, and it's really morally complex without being like weighty or a bummer to engage with. And it's just so funny. So we watched the whole first season for ATV, and I'm now continuing on to watch the second, third, and fourth season.
Where,
and it's only getting
is it
better.
Streaming?
Hulu.
Hulu, okay.
And the first season is only 6 episodes long. So It's just phenomenal. And I highly recommend it. And I think it's very reminiscent to me of Fleabag in terms of like the specificity of the comic voice and sharpness of observation. So that's my obsession.
What's your obsession, Anna?
My obsession is a developing one. I have gotten a copy of An Extraordinary Union by Alyssa Cole, which is...
Ooh, I'm so jealous. That book looks great.
Which has a fabulous cover. And it is about, it's set in the Civil War, which, let's be honest, I don't like American history, but I'm reading this anyway. It's a romance set in the Civil War, and the main characters are a former slave who is undercover in a Southern household and posing as a mute, and another guy who is undercover as well as a Confederate soldier, and they have, of course, an undeniable attraction. So I haven't read very much. I don't know where this is all going, but what I have read has made me want to drop things and get back to reading.
That sounds great.
It's always a good thing.
Yeah.
And I agree, the cover is amazing.
Yeah, it's fabulous.
It's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm. So my obsession came to me in the course of this episode when you asked me, wait, did you ask me online, or was it when we were offline, about Fleabag? Because it was when we were offline. There. Okay, so this is a TV show called Fleabag that I know nothing about, but has been mentioned to me twice today. The first time by a trusted colleague who understands my taste and the differences between our tastes in an astute way. I trust him to bring something to my attention that I would probably appreciate. And then Margaret mentioned it when we were offline a little earlier and gave me a quote relevant to my home life that makes me think that I would enjoy it. So we'll be adding that to our spreadsheet. Look for it in the next What to Watch Next bracket.
Okay. Well, does that mean we made it to the end?
I think we may have made it to the end.
I think we did.
Congratulations to us. Thanks for listening.
Yes.
If you've made it this far, congratulations.
Yeah.
And also thank you.
Endurance award.
Let us know if you listen to the whole thing, and I will personally thank you if you were so generous as to not fast forward when I was yammering.
Come and tweet us your favorite Harry Styles gif.
Yes, please.
Do. There's so many to choose from.
So many.
You're going to be so happy.
And if you DM so Sophie, she will send you your own.
Yeah.
If you want. I would never, ever send.
No, she's only into like, consensual gifting.
Only yes, exactly. Thank you. That is it, exactly.
You can find us on Twitter at Bellwether Friends, BellwetherFrnds. You can find us on Facebook. We're also on Tumblr intermittently. If you want, you can look us up on iTunes and leave us a review. Some people that we like have done that, including Margaret.
Thanks, Margaret.
Anytime, you two.
I'm Anna, and you can find me online at Helga Grace, HelgaGrace.
I'm Aline, and you can find me on Twitter at Surly Spice, SurlySpice.
And Two Bossy Dames.
I am Margaret. You can find me online at Mrs. Friday Next, And you can find my TV podcast at ATV Podcast on Twitter.
I'm Sophie. You can find me on Twitter as at Sophie Biblio, and you can find our newsletter as at Two Bossy Dames, all spelled out.
And you can sign up for our newsletter at tinyletter.com/twobossydames. Again, all spelled out. And it's pretty great, you guys. I'm not going to lie.
She's right.
You new issues correct. Friday nights.
At whatever time I manage to finish formatting them.
or me. Depends.
True, true.
We appreciate your honesty.
If it's late, it's usually me.
Understood. And our in and out music was provided by the lovely Julie Jurgens. You can find her on Twitter at Hi Miss Julie, HIMISSJULIE.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Producer Dick Wolf tramp stamps.
You saw that, right?
Yeah, okay. I did. And but I always pronounce it Dick Wolf as one word.
Oh, I thought you were gonna say I pronounce it tromp stomp.
Yes, I do.